Yes. All right. Well, here we are live with the Presidio Bitcoin Jam. Welcome, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Good. How are you guys doing?
Good.
You know, we've always intended with the show, we said, let's do no prep and just, you know, based on whatever we chat about in the group chat, and we're not going to go through all of our topics ahead of time. Well, this is the most, you know, ad hoc, off the cuff version we've had. So hopefully we're all having fun and doing it right.
Well, I'm ready to get started, but I'm looking into tweet, but I don't see our tweet.
Oh.
Or our X post.
Oh, right. We were supposed to get tagged. I think the...
Want to let people know about the show, right?
Maybe it is. Alex, do you know what's happening with the X post? Is that... It looks like it's streaming, but I don't know. Maybe it takes a second to... You do see it? Okay. I don't see it yet, but I'm sure it'll work itself out. If Max is already seeing it, then we'll see it in a moment, I guess.
What I did, I went into the light. You could see it. I didn't see it in my notifications.
Oh,
but I saw the live.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, you know, streaming. Okay. And I did. All right.
That's exactly right. Okay.
Thanks for everyone's patience.
Thank you. Yeah, we're like the amateur podcasters who are still, we have like beautiful studio, beautiful equipment, you know. Great, you know, producer.
I believe we got tint on the windows.
Oh, wow.
But unfortunately, it actually is a gray sky today.
Mm.
So we still don't know if we can show our audience a blue sky. So we'll have to see next week. Right. Unfortunately, the next few months, I think, are like Carl's here. You know, Carl the fog.
Oh, that starts like June, right?
I think it starts now.
Now? Oh, bummer.
Or at least it probably gets peaks then, maybe.
Right, right.
Yeah.
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 There it is.
Okay, cool. It's real. It's live.
So we were here Steve-less last week. It was just me and Max. And so I think we've got at least one topic that we'll cover a little bit later. But one of the topics that Steve saw Max and me just kind of ripping stuff out. And he was like, you guys are clowns. You can't do this topic without me.
I actually I listened to the show, though. So
yeah, yeah.
I was... Absent, but not absent.
You were participating.
Yes. It was nice to be on the other side of the table.
You know, you are allowed to participate in the chat. If you're listening right now, feel free to chime in. The chat is
yeah, I was engaging, listening, give some feedback. But I thought you guys did great.
Except for that.
Actually, I thought we don't have much to talk about here. It's just simply, I just wanted to let you guys know and then anyone listening know, don't be fooled if you look at a Bitcoin hash rate chart. If you're looking at too short of duration, and meaning if you look at like less than a 1 day window of time, it has very high error bars. So if you see something like, you know, it's 1,000 exahash per second or it surpassed that, it, like, I don't think it actually, has yet, even though you can look at some charts that show that. And the reason why is simple. You know, let's think about how do you measure hash rate? There's not like in the protocol a number that spits out the hash
rate.
Right,
yeah.
How do you measure it? The only way you measure it is based on the like the average block period that's being observed. And so you can't just do a small sample size because of the Poisson distribution of blocks. So you have to sort of get a large enough number of samples to distinguish between just sheer luck and just Poisson distribution from, oh, there's actually an increase or decrease in hash rate relative to the difficulty adjustment for that period.
I see. Yep.
Yeah. I think 7 day and 30 day are safer. But yeah, I mean, it is at 900. I mean, the larger point is, I mean, your point, Max, is just that it's growing. Or I mean, there's three different metrics, which are interesting to observe. We're at an all time high for hash rate. That's generally in isolation. That's good. That's healthy. We're at an all-time low, or very close to an all-time low, for hash price. So the how much revenue you generate per, you know, hash that you have. The mempool is also empty. Like, there's not a lot of demand for Bitcoin transactions right now. So the last two, well, I think hash price, I think even in a healthy Bitcoin, it declines over time. So it declining or being an all-time low, I don't think is like a negative indicator. Definitely lack of demand is a negative indicator. I don't think it's like panic mode. It's been low basically throughout the history of Bitcoin. There's really more like spurts when it's high demand, but the default case is usually low. The only reason it's been high the past couple of years is because of ordinals and inscriptions and non-money transactions. And, you know, so we didn't have money transactions then, and we don't really have them now, or not enough to fill blocks. So it's just interesting comparing those three.
And are we at a, did you say we're at an all-time high with that, or? Oh, we got a comment from Positive Blue that said, there's a problem with Max audio. I cannot hear him in the stream. So when Max is talking, we just see his mouth moving. Oh, it sounds like because of the mute, but that's going to cause some.
Don't do that.
That's going to cause some feedback. Uh-oh, now we're in a bind. I think, Max, you got to participate in the chat. Just text us your commentary.
We can hear you.
We can hear you.
I don't think the line.
We can hear you. I think it didn't make it out. I get it, yeah. I don't think we want to, it'll be tough to talk if we undo that.
I think our options are right now, DK and I carry the torch, or we end the show, and probably, Max, why don't you participate in the chat though?
Yeah. Pop in and jam with us.
Feel free. Well, Jordy is saying that if it's in the recording, we'll at least have it later.
We don't know if that's the case.
Yeah.
We do? Oh, okay.
So yeah. It makes for a funky live stream, yeah. But a good recording. I'm cool with either way.
Okay.
What's Jordy? Jordy, what do you want us to do? We'll see if he responds. Well, let's just roll with Max. It's a little funky live stream. Sorry, folks, but it's a mystery too.
Max, like, give us yeses and nos. You're only allowed to give us yes, I agree, or no, I disagree.
Yeah. We'll minimize Max's airtime this show. Okay. Anyway, I don't think there's much more to talk about the hash rate. I mean, the main thing I wanted to point out is just so that not only are the three of us, but the audience knows not to ever be fooled by a like less than one day hash rate. And then the larger topic though is like, just continue observing these metrics, and low demand for transactions is bad for Bitcoin all time. And then all time high in hash rate. That along with all time low in hash price simply means that miner margins are getting, you know, crunched.
So miners may be getting squeezed. And presumably they have some capital structure that gives them some buffer. Some of them may not.
Levered debt.
Well, I mean, but they're not going to like turn off tomorrow, right?
Yeah. Like, I think
a lot of the public lenders,
I mean, you can look at their stats, they're, you know, taking on debt to do CapEx expenditures. And then the economical, once you acquire that and have that sunk cost, the economical thing to do is plug it in.
Yep. But do you know anything so about the terms of that debt? Like, do they have 30 days, 90 days, a year or two?
I don't. So, you know, but if price goes down, there's, like, as we've seen in past cycles, then miners are going to get crushed.
Right, right.
But also, as we've, go ahead. Yeah, I'll answer that in a second, but I like Jordy's guidance for us. He says to summarize what Max says and don't let him go on a rant in this episode. That might get, like, that might be good guidance in general. Anyway, so Max asked, you know, should we be concerned about low demand? I mean, definitely long term, yes, because Bitcoin experiment fails if there's not demand for Bitcoin transactions. And meaning, if everything is done in databases or off chain, and there just simply isn't demand where there's a willingness to pay transaction fees for censorship resistant transactions, then Bitcoin's not really needed. I mean, the world's demonstrating we don't need censorship transactions for a global network for the internet.
I'm not trying to defend the current state of affairs, but I'm curious to make sure that my understanding is clear. If somebody's doing Lightning transactions, those had a on-chain transaction to open the channel, but they don't require on-chain transactions most of the time, right? While the channels are open.
Correct.
And I'm not saying that the whole thing is happening on Lightning today, but like, there could be a good state of the world where lot of transactions happen on Lightning.
Right. My comments are long term. I mean, it's important when this conversation, let's have, you know, long term and short term in terms of concern. So long term, we should absolutely concern. Literally, the Bitcoin experiment would fail.
Yep.
Because it would just prove, like, society doesn't need censorship resistant global monetary transfer. And in the short term, there's no need to panic, but as we talk a lot about in the show, like, we need to find ways to use Bitcoin beyond just digital rock. And if we find those ways, including Lightning, and so yes, you can open a Lightning channel that is on chain, one transaction, and then you can do lots of payments after that. But if that becomes really popular, I mean, the flip side of the argument is people are like, Lightning doesn't scale because it requires too many on-chain transactions.
Right, right, right.
So whether it's Lightning or any of the other variety of ways to scale Bitcoin, they all require on-chain footprint.
Right.
So really, it all comes down to people needing to use Bitcoin and not have it all just be like within Cash App's database,
right,
or Coinbase, or like one company. Even like with eCash, like if you know, let's say DK has a Cashew wallet and you send me money and I'm using Cash App, that's going to be via Lightning.
Mm-hmm.
So, which at least requires some on-chain activity.
Right.
Right.
And I guess, I mean, in the, you know, if we have really great Lightning use cases and lots of usage there, presumably for, you know, the next decade, we're going to see an increase in Lightning channels opened, and that's going to create a bunch of online or on-chain activity, right? So it's not to say that, like, things are all good, steady as she goes, but it's like, just try to understand what the contours of Lightning's impact on that might look like. And I guess I'm a fan of, like, let's find more use cases. I feel like use cases is kind of the main thing holding it back. I keep saying I think it's use cases more than infrastructure. They're obviously a bit of chicken and egg, and they have to grow simultaneously, but I think the use cases matter a ton. So I'm still an advocate of, like, let's get more use cases. I'm working on it myself. I know a lot of other people we know work on it. But what would that world look like if those use cases don't emerge and you've got, like, Coinbase has some database transactions and Cash App has some database transactions and all that. Like, do you get, you don't get censorship peer-to-peer electronic cash, censorship resistant peer-to-peer electronic cash. What do you get? What does that thing look like? Is it?
Well, the reason I would, I'm like making this bold assertion that the Bitcoin experiment fails yeah. is that there'd be no revenue to be made by miners. So right. there'd be no incentive. The central bank would fall apart, or the decentralized central, the transaction processor engine of Bitcoin falls apart because there's no economic incentive to select transactions for the network. And then it's obviously easily gameable and it's not secure anymore.
But like if the Coinbase transaction were sending something from their database to the Cash App transaction, presumably those would be on-chain? There just would be very few of them?
Yeah, well, they have a Lightning channel or some other technology.
Mm-hmm. It would prevent needing to do kind of an on-chain transaction.
Yeah, I mean, if they're using Lightning, then you're using on-chain to establish that.
Mm-hmm. But like, I think if I understand right, like Cash App and
that
Lightning.
That would be usage though,
Cash App
right?
and Coinbase could already have a Lightning channel established from like a while back and they don't need to keep closing it out. They can just sort of use it.
I guess
without creating on-chain.
One example though, I mean, while usage of Bitcoin in many ways we talk about is nascent, exchanges like Cash App and Coinbase is not nascent. Like that's real. There's a lot of activity there. And as we see in the data, there's not sufficient demand for on-chain transactions.
Do these existing players like, you know, Cash App, you know, Coinbase, you know, say River, I don't know who all would be sort of the typical ones to quote in that scenario. But if they're actually doing any kind of resolution they want to settle a transaction between themselves, do they actually go on chain or do they also have like their own out of band mechanisms of exchange?
I mean, anything's possible. I think it's typically on chain and starting to be Lightning. I mean, like 7-8 years ago, BitGo had a Lightning like proprietary service
mm-hmm.
that I think was somewhat adopted, but not really used that much. Mm-hmm. But anything's possible.
Mm-hmm. And we can't really, there's no trace of what might be happening. We don't see big transactions happen or not happen that we think are attributed to one of the large orgs that are managing custody.
We have a pretty good idea of the on-chain footprint for each exchange because their addresses have been labeled. They've been like surveillance companies and even mm-hmm. open source projects have been able to identify like Binance and Coinbase and Cash App activity on-chain. So we have a pretty good idea of the footprint of each. I don't know where you're going with this.
No, I was just trying to understand a little more. I guess about how to interpret the degree of on-chain activity. You know, sort of where we are with it. Because you're sort of talking about how there's very few transactions right now, but it sounds like it's kind of in the range of what it often is when there's not a big ordinals runes type demand for block space. So we're sort of are we kind of back to the new normal, but not like what we would hope for, what we think would be a healthy looking version of it. Like it wouldn't last this way for decades and be successful, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not like there's zero transactions. The blocks are being filled, but it's like there's very few remaining in the mempool that aren't being mined in like the next block. So that is... We don't know definitively, but again, it's not like it was a huge success historically and all of a sudden it's plummeted. I don't think we've ever had much demand for on-chain transactions in terms of payments. It's the spikes. It's if you look at the history of the mempool, it's typically not full. And in periods when it is full, we do know what that is. And it's things like inscriptions mm-hmm. or it's Roger Ver like spamming attacks in 2017 or whatever. So mm-hmm. we, so it's actually rare to see it congested. And we have a strong idea for each time it's been congested. Like December 2017, the price on-chain fees rose to like 1,000 sats per V value or something very high. And that was during the chaos of, you know, the price running up to 20K or whatever. Mm-hmm. And also at that time, no exchanges had any optimizations for their on-chain footprint. So people buying and selling and moving coins to and from their own wallets, it was very inefficient at the time. Now that's been optimized. So even if we see like 5x increase of that activity from those exchanges from then till now, the on-chain footprint is probably about the same mm-hmm. because of those optimizations. So again, it's rare for it to spike. When it does spike, we generally know what it's from. So I think we can generally conclude that over time, there's just been modest at best demand for payments on chain.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're going to fix that by building more things.
Yes.
That use Bitcoin. And so some of those things are likely to come about with the Presidio Bitcoin Hackathon, which we've been talking about. I think, do we have a date firmed up?
May 16th.
May 16th, 17th.
I believe, we've announced it on here 3 times at least, but I think it's going to be formally announced hopefully today.
There's a website, you can click a thing and apply or...
A website that was vibe coded.
Awesome.
By Austin.
Is that vibe debugged as well?
We'll see. I don't know. When we launch, we'll see how many bugs there are. But there'll be a website. Is an application process so people can apply. It's open to anyone. You don't have to, you can live anywhere, you can have any background is available, because with vibe coding you don't have to have a bunch of programming experience. So programmers are welcome, non-programmers are welcome. I would expect the majority of people to be from the Bay Area just because it's local. Mm-hmm. We are going to do a targeted marketing effort towards local universities like Stanford and UC Berkeley. In fact, I think we lost Max again, but Max is going to go speak at UC Berkeley, and we'll probably do something similar at Stanford. And so hopefully we have a lot of young talent from those universities come and show us what they got. Uh-huh. The only requirement is that the project has to build on Bitcoin, use Bitcoin, somehow utilize Bitcoin. People can use AI tools if they want. They don't have to. They can incorporate Nostr if they want to. They don't have to. It can be AI related. Doesn't have to. But yeah.
And are there going to be people on site who can help kind of TA or coach people through? So if you show up with an idea of what you want to build on Bitcoin, but you don't have your vibe coding stack even established, and you're just like non-technical, is there going to be somebody on site, or maybe some people on site who can help walk you through that? Is that part of the experience?
Yeah, we're going to have several technology partners here. That it's been really good. We have Lightspark is going to be here. Block is going to be here with their Goose tool. Lexi is a startup that works out of Presidio Bitcoin. They're going to be here. Albi Hub will be represented. And I think Bob Scully and his startup is gonna be here. So we're gonna have 4 or 5 different, maybe there's even another one, technology partner, representatives from those orgs will be here. Each of them on Friday night, the opening night, each of them will have an opportunity to do a quick educational session and introduction to their own technologies. And participants can use those tools if they want to or not. And then they'll be around all day Saturday to provide tech support.
So it sounds like there's each of the kind of partners who have technologies that may get used will have somebody on site to sort of help people use those technologies. But in the broader sense, like if you have an idea of something you want to build on Bitcoin and you've heard about vibe coding but don't know much about it, is there kind of like a getting started track, or can Austin or somebody, I'm happy to help with that, but I missed the planning meeting. So I don't know if that's already been accounted for or if that's needed.
I don't How to get started with vibe coding? I think that's tentative. Or I mean, we can do that.
Okay. Well, because it sounds like part of the okay. Awesome.
Okay.
So we're going to hear about vibe coding on Noster when Max comes back, just in case you're
next
in the
week.
Live. And next week, yeah. But Max is going to drop for now because we're having some technical difficulties and patching him in right. So back to just a cozy one-on-one.
All right. So, the hackathon. So, I think it makes a lot of sense to like give an intro to vibe coding. I mean, but it should be, it'll probably be addressed by at least, Angie Jones is going to be here and speak about Goose, right? So, mm-hmm. We'll definitely cover that.
Cool.
Anyone wanting to participate who wants to learn how to do that, I guarantee you we're going to have people here.
Can we make sure that the call is out that if you love Bitcoin and want to build something on Bitcoin and you don't consider yourself technical, have never deployed software before, this is still appropriate to apply because you're going to be able to go from zero to whatever. And if you're already super experienced, you can do even more.
I agree. I think the best participants to come are those with like really exciting ideas that they want to see created. Because with the tools now, you don't have to know how to code.
Yeah.
And you can build so quickly that it's realistic to build a really compelling proof of concept in a 24-hour hackathon.
It's totally insane. So I think you shared with me, can we talk about the one you shared with me?
Yeah. Miles? So
is it Effectivo?
Yes.
Dot money, is it?
Yeah, well, I don't know if he wants people. That's the URL. But
sorry, Miles.
I'm not sure you can handle the load from
the spike
our entire audience.
Everybody's gonna hammer it at
website.
Once. Yeah.
But Effectivo is the I think it's Spanish. I mean,
Spanish for cash.
And I'm the only one on here who doesn't speak Spanish. Max also, I took Spanish in high school.
Venga.
Yeah. No, but no. All right. So, we mentioned Miles on the show a few weeks ago. Miles worked at Block. He's long time, like 7 or 8 years, has led Bitcoin at Cash App. Great guy. But as we pointed out, philosophy major, right? I mean, he doesn't have programming experience. And what he's done, I find like incredibly inspirational. And he's become completely addicted to vibe coding. I was saying before the show, I now know two people that are more addicted than you, DK. And I know
that's
how
crazy.
I know your level of commitment.
Yeah.
You're like telling me you're not going to do this, that, and the other thing because you're too busy vibe coding.
Yeah.
And I actually, Miles, I think, spend more time than you. So he set out a couple weeks ago, or two, three weeks ago, he got started on this. And he's wanted to build like a money app that has stable coins and Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
And, Cash App may or may not have it one day, but he at least wanted to like see what it looks like.
You say a money app, like a wallet or something? A wallet where you can receive...
Send and receive money.
Send and receive money. But that money is not just the money we talk about, Bitcoin. It can also be a stable coin on top
dollars
of
dollars or
any
Bitcoin globally.
Any blockchain, or it doesn't matter.
Dollars and Bitcoin. User experience is you want to send dollars and Bitcoin
just
globally.
Just going to try to do all the interchange and figure out.
Internally, awesome. You know, those are just details, right?
Great. Yeah, I love it.
So, that was his goal. So he started vibe coding and then he quickly realized how powerful that is. And he could just express what he wanted in English and it revealed itself. So
and his role in his daytime job, he's kind of like a product manager type.
Product manager.
Okay. So he kind of has like understanding of technology and how it's built, but not maybe in a coding or
I believe he has no programming experience. Definitely has like product ideas. And he understands like Bitcoin technology well. Mm-hmm. But not programming experience. So let me, a couple things that I find fascinating about this. First of all, what he's built, he has a functional wallet, works in a web browser. It supports on-chain Bitcoin, Lightning, USDC, and Solana, all mainnet, all real.
Wow.
So you can take any other wallet and send it and receive. I've used it. It all works. I found probably like 5 bugs in my experience, and he was able to turn around and fix all of them like within seconds or minutes. It's like crazy. Again, he's not a programmer, and you know.
Do you know what stack he's using? Is he on Replit agent?
Lovable.
Lovable is kind of the front end stuff.
Lovable.
That's the only thing he's using.
And then he
the
database in the back end. He's done a lot of studying, and the way he is describing what he's having to do, like, it's very clear this has been an incredible teaching tool for him as well. Just the way he is talking about what he's having to do, I'm like, wow, you actually are learning to program, basically. Yeah. So it's not only relatively simple to type in English and make things happen, but he's developing skills to debug problems that a programmer would have to do. And it's just fascinating to watch that. So I'm just impressed that he's created something that really does function across all those different blockchains and technologies.
Mm-hmm.
It works on mainnet and is interoperable with everyone else's products. It's pretty incredible.
And can you tell us a little bit, just if you have the knowledge about it, like how did he get Lightning to work? Is it custodial Lightning? Does he run a node that is plugged in? Or
he's currently using Voltage.
Okay.
So it's cloud-hosted nodes. And so the onboarding experience, it's not bad. It's not perfect. To start using it, he requires email registration. I don't know exactly why, but he does. But that's simple. And then to use Lightning, you have to enter a URL to your Voltage node in the cloud, which is unique to the user.
Yeah.
So the user needs that URL.
Yeah.
And you need a Macaroon token. So you just need like a token that uniquely identifies you. I haven't really probed that. So it seems like you get away with just one identifier, not two.
I think D++ told me, is that part of how LND works? The Macaroon thing is like an identifier for LND?
Yeah. I'm encouraging him to try out Lexi as well. Mm-hmm. I think there's a number.
Yeah, the Lexi onboarding experience is like a
number of advantages there. I think it'll be a slicker onboarding. And they support Bolt 12 as well. And he's excited to add Bolt 12 to his wallet. But that's how he's currently doing it. And it works. So
great.
And then, you know, someone asked, you know, why does he have Solana in his wallet? Well, that's needed for gas fees for the USDC.
Right.
But he has some ideas to remove that as well, like from the user interface. So
it'll just abstract it. It's still running Solana.
Which I think Shazan has done or has talked about doing with Lava as well. And then the UI.
I think in the case of Shazan, he has a business, so they could probably subsidize to some extent. But is the Miles idea to subsidize it or to actually do something that would otherwise make it go away?
I don't know how he plans to make it go away. He just doesn't want the UI because it's a shitty UX,
yep,
right?
Yep, agreed.
bless you.
Excuse me.
And then the UI, the visual appeal to the app, it's pretty good. I mean, I think you went to the web page. That's interesting. But the actual app itself, it feels and looks like Cash App or, you know, like a modern UI. So it's super impressive.
You say the app itself, meaning the mobile web version of that.
I haven't used it on
experience.
Mobile yet, but he thought I was using a mobile, so he like fixed all these bugs to work on mobile, and I'm like, I'm just using it on a desktop, so I still need to try it out on mobile.
Mm-hmm.
No, I just mean, you know, doesn't matter what hardware device you're using, just the UI of the wallet. Yeah,
cool.
So I've only used it on Chrome on Mac OS.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
But it's just everything about it is amazing. I mean, it's what we talked about for 2 months now about the amazingness of vibe coding. But I'd say there's two apps that I've used from friends who have been vibe coding that are pretty impressive. One is what he built. It's still, you know, I would call it like between alpha and beta quality. And it probably, if you actually scaled it up, would fall down for many reasons, but still it's like pretty intense. I mean, to put this in perspective, like 4 or 5 years ago, the first people who tried to build a mobile wallet or web wallet with LDK, it took very talented developers like over a year just to get something the quality of what he has right now.
Yep.
It's improved tremendously. And like he, the infrastructure, the tools, not just AI tools, but just the actual Bitcoin development kit tools have gotten much better, to the point where he built this in a few weeks. So that's really impressive. And then,
I mean, he's one of the two who's more obsessed than me.
The other person who's more obsessed than you, I think, I don't know if he wants his name mentioned, so just it's a mutual friend of ours, but he, he's built a number of apps, but the one that I've been using is a, it's a simple game. It's called Last Letters, and he built it with this kid, and I played it as well. And it's just a, it's a simple game, kind of like, you know, like a little bit of Scrabble, a little bit of Wordle, that type of game. But a very elegant UI, very fun gameplay. That you have, it's a two-player game. Like I just type in a word, you can see it, and then you have to I pass it to you. You have to, and we can play remote too, I think. Then you, it's your, when it's your turn, your word has to start with the letter that was the last letter in the word I chose, right? And then you, you score your word similar to Scrabble scoring. So but the more the letters, the rarer the letters, you get a higher score. But you can't reuse a letter that's already been used.
Right.
So if, you know, if we have the word like, you know, Bitcoin, well, it ends in an N, you have to choose a word that starts with N, but you can't, no one can then choose a word that ends in N.
You can have internal repeats. Like Ninja has two N's, that's fine.
No, it's, you can't, when you're choosing a word, you cannot choose a word that starts with a letter that has been a last letter already.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So, so it shows a little like letter board that shows you which have been used and you can't reuse those.
And
it's fun. It's actually fun.
It's a game concept they came up with from scratch, right?
I've never heard of it. Right? So I think to the point of like who are the best kind of people to come to a hackathon? It's people with great ideas, right?
Yeah.
So this, it's a simple game, but it really is compelling. Like it feels like the kind of game that like millions of people around the world would want
almost
to
like
play.
A Wordle type thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
It feels like that. And it's visually beautiful. It's a very nice UI. I mean, it looks like you hired a professional designer to do it. I don't know all the prompts he had to do to create that, like how much guidance he had to give for that versus it just had, I mean, he definitely has commented on how good of intuition the AI has from prompts. But anyway, that's super.
And do you know for his stack, is he doing Replit Agent or is he doing kind of a mix of more
advanced
tools?
He's using Replit Agent.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's what you use too, right? Because you guys built a game or like a virtual world or something?
Two video games that were late 70s, early 80s sort of style and visual, like graphics ability, but like compelling games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how long did each one take you?
30 minutes each or something.
30 minutes per game.
Very fast.
And did you end
like literally the first prompt was like create a game that has an axolotl in it and then hit return, and 5 minutes later or whatever it produced all the code and it was already a working game.
Right.
And then it was just simply iterating like, oh, add levels, add the ability to change the color of the axolotl, add predators that will eat the axolotl, stuff like that.
And do you think that there's, like, I think about, I mean, your programming background, but your kid's not. Do you feel like you're giving, you're sort of like...
No, I'm not involved.
You're not involved?
No.
Oh.
I mean, I'm there.
You're just standing there watching it happen.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So I think this kind of stuff where you're coming up with a game thing first and then sort of adding Bitcoin later is the thing that we haven't seen much experimentation on. Like, because the world has basically been like, hey, I'm going to make a new Bitcoin wallet and it's non-custodial or it's custodial or it has a special new technology. But everybody's basically building a Bitcoin wallet in some way. Just like in Nostr, everybody builds a social media client. Fine. It makes sense. Like, it's kind of, it's like a natural first step. But what I'm hoping we see, and I think we already have a lot of this energy coming up, is the stuff like what you were doing or he was doing, where it's like you just come up with a game idea that doesn't exist in the world, you think is really cool, and you get it out there. But you have like kind of some familiarity with Bitcoin or some appreciation or love for it. And then you're like, oh, actually, I think Bitcoin could somehow make my game better, right? Instead of making the game about Bitcoin, make the game great.
Yeah.
And then sort of...
You've said that for like at least 3 or 4 years. And
yeah. And I then totally later, agree. Bitcoin and later.
I feel like we're... This is the time we're going to see that shift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like everybody that I show vibe coding to, the first thing they do is they make some sort of like art project or game. Yeah. Like people aren't like, oh, I'm going to make like vertical SaaS software. I mean, which you could, right? And you could make probably some money doing that. But people are like, I'm going to make art, which I think is like the right... It's like a healthy... You know, let your creative energy out and do something that you want to do and express an idea. That to me feels like the magic of this, that this unlocks, and it makes everything so low cost to achieve that, you know, you can just, you just rip, do something new, rip, do something new.
Yeah.
So you were looking at comments. Was there anything?
No, I think
anything.
Cool.
I see Max chatting a lot, but you're like, no, none of this interesting.
We're good.
Keep rolling.
Sorry if you drop some of the shows. Too bad. No, super excited about the hackathon coming up. So anyone listening that is interested, be on the lookout. Just follow Presidio Bitcoin on X, and you'll see the announcement. Or you can hit up DK or me, and we'll point you to it. Let's see.
Now, I don't know if you were going to represent... Do you want to talk about IP? Because I think it's kind of relevant to this topic.
Okay, sure.
I've got at least a transition, but I don't know if that was something you were going to talk about.
I was going to mention Design Week as well. Maybe just really briefly, and then we'll do IP. This is much earlier in its formation, but another event that we're planning at Presidio Bitcoin is doing a Bitcoin Design Week in September, probably middle of December, September. Current thinking is Monday through Friday that week, have around 20 designers come, or a total of 20 people, mostly designers, and really come up with like, beforehand, come up with like, what are the biggest design challenges in Bitcoin? Use that as input, and then have a 5-day event where designers can work on solutions and come up with some creative ideas there. And then for our second hackathon, actually, at Presidio Bitcoin, will be adjacent to that. So the following weekend, I mean, it would be a continuation of the design week, would be our second hackathon, where, again, there's been no preparation for you know, planning or thinking around that. But presumably, you know, making it related to the design week, and probably like some of the designs that were created, that would be, there'd be prizes or whatever for building things that are based on the work that was just done during design week.
Yep. And I know you instigated a big Bitcoin design community, I think, several years ago.
5 years ago.
5 years ago. And when I think a lot of times, you know, traditional kind of tech design builders are thinking about like UX and UI and how products work and stuff. But I think Bitcoin design, from my understanding, is often like a very different thing. It doesn't kind of start from like, I think it starts in kind of a different way. So I'm wondering, are there examples, just to help us understand a little bit about what does design in Bitcoin mean? It's probably not like flashy animations and stuff, right? Which I think most designers would not consider the purpose of design. But some people may go there and think that that's what we mean. So can you give us like maybe a concrete example of something that, you know, a problem that was identified and that is the kind of thing that a Bitcoin designer might be considering?
Sure. And before giving concrete examples, I'll just speak to, you know, why is Bitcoin different? If we're talking about Bitcoin that is self-custodial, or like the most trust minimized version of Bitcoin, designing for that is extremely challenging because of technical challenges that no one else has had to deal with. Whereas if it's like a custodial application, like Cash App or Coinbase or something, then design is much more, for most aspects, much more traditional. Like you could hire any Silicon Valley designer to work on Cash App or Coinbase design, and they'd feel at home and create a nice design. And, you know, both of those products have like kind of designs you'd expect.
And ultimately, we're kind of talking about either like you're controlling the 12 words to the Bitcoin, or you have like a login and password that kind of gets you access to it. That's, at least in my mind, that's kind of how I think of that, about the two. Is that the right?
That's the high level.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, trust minimization, there's spectrum, right? So certainly controlling your own keys is the most important aspect, but there's other things too. Like are you running your own Bitcoin full node would be another one, right? Because otherwise, if you're not, then you're trusting others to like not fudge the data, right? So designing for trust minimized Bitcoin introduces all kinds of challenges. You definitely have to understand more of the technical constraints and just today's reality, and then try your best to create a good user experience around that. So that's just a huge category. The other category of design challenges is Bitcoin is this global interoperable system, right? So like if you're designing your Bitcoin product, I'm designing my Bitcoin product, there are some aspects of the system that I actually, my design is going to be influenced by yours and by influenced by this other app and this other app and this other app. There's interoperability, and that's around payment protocols and also certain aspects of copy, like the text that you see or the icons you see. If every single app comes up with their own idea for what words or naming should be,
right,
or what the visuals should be, or like the symbol of Bitcoin. And, you know, we've talked about, so you want a concrete example. A concrete example is how do you represent an amount in Bitcoin, right? And so historically, one Bitcoin, there's one of 21 million Bitcoin. But as we've talked about on the show, there's the actual unit, the smallest unit of Bitcoin that's in the code and in the protocol itself. In the consensus protocol, it's a unit that some call sats or satoshis, but it's 1/100 millionth of one Bitcoin. Or in other words, there's 2.1 quadrillion units in Bitcoin. That's a hard fact. That's not debatable. That is how consensus works and how the code works. But how is it represented to people? It's not been represented that way historically. It's been represented as, you know, one Bitcoin is what everyone listening thinks of one Bitcoin. So there are norms that have developed. And pretty much every product defines one Bitcoin as what people think of as one Bitcoin. Some products, though, like Bob's Boardwalk Cash, is pushing the boundaries and defines a Bitcoin as what others call a sat, and just forgoes the naming of sat or Satoshi. And then, of course, there's been a movement the past 3 or 4 years on like, oh, let's introduce sats, that unit.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certainly like a rabid fan base of that that's relatively small, but most people don't even understand what that is. Like, is it another shitcoin or like, what is this term?
There literally are
shitcoins called, there's tokens. If you search that like on Google, you'll actually find that instead of Bitcoin. So that's an example of where design is impacted, and you can't just like unilaterally decide yourself how your app is represented. And that's pretty different than most products that are designed. So those two categories of are what make Bitcoin design sort of unique, special, hard, different. And that's why I think the design community and then the Bitcoin design guide that they've created, I think it's a really good foundation and start. It still needs to get even better, but it'll become a really essential tool for the Bitcoin space, because any builder, well, for two reasons. One, any human builder should be able to just have this resource that helps them with these design challenges, because many of them, you don't need to come up with your own solution. Like other smart people have already figured it out. And like either here's clearly the best solution or there's trade-offs.
Right.
So here's the two that are viable options, and the pros and cons of each, present that to you. So you as a builder are like, okay, this one matches my needs better. Yep. I'm going to go with that. Or it's starting point, at least. I'll go with that and then tweak it for my needs. But it's way better than everyone coming up with something from scratch. And now with AI tools, like it's like pretty obvious to me, feed the design guide into the AI tool, right? And the AI tool will use that as a basis. So I look forward to, I mean, we're going to do this very soon, right? If not myself or one of my friends who is vibe coding or at the hackathon, someone's going to feed the design guide in, and we're going to see how well it works. I'm optimistic it'll actually work pretty well, pretty good. But I also suspect we'll find like 100 things to improve about it,
right,
to optimize for the AI tools. I kind of liken it to like search engine optimization back in the day when that was like discovered.
Yeah.
It became a thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you want to like climb the search results,
get
in Google,
yeah,
there was like a playbook to follow, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we should come up with a terminology. So we're the ones that coined this term, but I don't know what the right terminology is to coin it. But basically, whether it be a design guide or a software development kit or API or library, optimizing it for AI tool consumption is already becoming a thing and will be it'll be like an industry in and of itself.
Right. I was going to mention that some of the vibe coding I've done runs into this problem. So you and I committed to each other that we would not use the term Satoshis and we would just call those Bitcoin and just like surprise people and just act like it's normal. And I committed to you that, and I was mostly doing it, except when I was interacting with the LLM for vibe coding, it did not understand what I meant. So you know that snake game I made, mm-hmm, that was like a lightning thing. It asks you to deposit Satoshis because if it asked you to deposit Bitcoin, it would think it meant the old Bitcoin, not the new Bitcoin.
Thanks for sharing that. It would be interesting to point the AI to John Carvalho's BIP21Q draft or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Just to inform it of this idea to see if that...
BIP21Q, that's the quantum thing?
No, that's the... it's the idea we're talking about. It's changing the units of Bitcoin.
Oh, okay.
From... one Bitcoin is one in 21 million.
Quadrillion.
2.1.
I thought the Q was the quantum Q.
No.
Quadrillion Q.
Yes.
Got it.
Right.
Okay.
So you could point the AI to that so it's more informed.
Yeah.
But also, like, yeah, if there was a design guide out there that spoke to this, then that could be input as well.
So this design topic, I know this is not really design. Well, it touches on some of these themes, but it made me curious about a little bit of history. Like, why is Bitcoin orange? What made that happen?
I mean, the original logo was orange, right? And it's tilted at, I forget how many degrees, but,
Was that a Satoshi thing or a Mami thing or?
I don't know who did it. I don't think it was Satoshi. I think it was just an early, you know, participant advocate, proposed the logo and it's stuck.
And it kind of stuck, right?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So we talked.
So yeah. So anyway, I mean, we'll talk about the design week on the show as it evolves.
Yeah.
But just sort of like some early alpha for people that, yeah, knowing that that's coming. And so anyone listening, if you are a designer or you're excited about Design Week or you know someone who would be, reach out to Presidio Bitcoin or me and to get involved or share ideas you have. That would be great. You wanted to talk about the delete IP?
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you. So I saw the headline and I think we added it to the title of the show, but I don't know much about it except that I saw the headline. I think was Elon and Jack were squabbling over it or agreeing about it, or what was the...
I believe, so I haven't looked at all the social media dramas. I don't know who, but I think Elon and Jack are both, I mean, Jack tweeted delete IP. I think Elon did too. So I think they're on the same side. They both are pushing that narrative and that topic for discussion. I mean, it's something, I'll just speak from my own perspective. I've agreed with that direction since, you know, at least 15 years.
Hmm.
And for me, where I started questioning IP law, particularly patents, was when I was at Google. And I mean, prior to that, growing up, I thought, oh, patents protect the little guy. They protect inventors, innovators, right? Mm-hmm. And protect them against the big guy.
Right.
Like if you're just an individual who has a great idea,
right,
it gives you this like window of time to flourish with your idea. And, you know, the big corporations can't just swoop in, steal it and copy it and succeed. So that makes sense to me. And I think that was the intention in like what the late 19th century or whatever, when,
right,
the IP law was created in the US, or patents at least. But when I was at Google, I saw a different angle, which Google at that time had never offensively asserted their patents.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed internally there was this like enormous effort to file patents.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I have something like 30 patents under my name.
Yeah, don't you get like a bonus or something if you...
I got bonuses. I have these plaques that I still have owned. Yeah. I have so many patents.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. They're just all mostly nonsense.
Right.
And I had very little... I gave very little effort to create these patents.
Yeah.
So it's like a total farce.
I thought they had like attorneys. They would be like, oh, just sit down with them for lunch.
Yes.
You can tell them something.
So,
you create
a machine. So you have... it's exactly what you said. So there's like a legal team spun up to just create as many patents as possible. You have a lunch or brief meeting with engineers or PMs to get some details and then file these patents. And it just creates a war chest. Now, why did Google do that? Not because they're evil, but because Google was a target to be sued by other companies, but more likely patent trolls.
Yep.
So patent trolls are just awful for the industry in the world. I mean, it's the opposite of like an inventor creating something that creates value in the world and they just want to protect it. Patent trolls collect all these patents, either file them or acquire them cheaply, don't build any products. They add no value to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And all they do is go around and sue others. And the people they sue are, well, they want to go after the Googles. They want to go after where the money is, but they might start with the little guy. Because they want
to
establish track record.
Yeah.
So then they go after the little guy, harm the little guy, like a startup that does not have the legal defense budget or, you know, that's just not what you want to focus on when you're starting a company.
Yeah.
So it's a horrible system. So Google wanted a war chest. And I mean, the reason they bought Motorola was for patents, not for like flip phones or whatever.
Razor Android.
So I just really had a strong distaste for patents. Also, like when Amazon patented OneClick, I thought that was like the most absurd thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
I mean, like that, like OneClick is not some like genius. Of course, it's a nice UX, but like it's so obvious.
It's obvious, yeah.
And if it like,
of the standards. It's got to be non-obvious. And they call it obvious.
Yeah. I mean,
they call it non-obvious and you're saying it's obvious, which it is.
It's so obvious, right? And then another dynamic, like comparing like 1880 till now, to create value in the world, the speed at which you can create value now is so fast that, and also the resources required are small. So, are low that, I just think it's like completely outdated.
Yeah.
Structure and institution. And so it has non-debatable harms, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine anyone arguing some of the problems I just mentioned are not like major problems and like just bad and dumb. And then if we were to look at like, oh, what are the upsides? I think they've greatly diminished.
Right.
Then you throw in China, and China historically is not respected intellectual property. And, you know, and before we like criticize China too much, the United States was exactly the same in its history. It just ripped off Great Britain.
Right.
but once the US actually started creating intellectual property within the United States, then all of a sudden like, oh, we need to take this. We gotta take this seriously and not copy others. And we need to make it punish people who like copy and steal.
Right.
But China is still in a mode of like copy and steal and a small but specific example of that, someone who works for Brains, the mining software, the Bitcoin mining software company, just he must have been at like an Asian conference or event or something, but I think he met this Chinese guy in person who had taken BitX software and taken Brain software.
Right.
And just started using them. And I think both of those products, the license is copyleft. I don't know if it's which variation of GPL or which license it is, but it's copyleft where, it's not necessarily copyleft. Whatever the license is, if you make modifications, you have to to upstream them back. Mm-hmm. You have to publish.
Contribute them.
And yeah. Contribute them back. And this company or person or whatever wasn't doing that. And it was, he was just sort of like, you know, unabashedly doing it. And he's telling the Christian who's at Brains, like, yeah, this is just the way it is. I mean, it's just, it's a culture in China. So anyway, so then with the rise of AI, it also muddies the waters.
Yeah.
But I think my understanding of like what Jack and probably Elon, why are they raising this now and vocalizing it, is the disadvantage that America and Western society is at relative to China. If we have outdated or draconian IP laws that China doesn't follow in the age of like AI and like insane velocity development mm-hmm. of new ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think we have a lot of, you know, a lot of content is often like people are kind of stuck in the way that it currently works. And if you're not really thinking about how it's going to work or the future we're moving toward, it feels unfair to not be able to defend your copyright or your trademark or your patent. But if you are looking a little bit around the corner, you can recognize that you're going to get to a place where being able to create things is so cheap and easy that I always think of like IP law as helping kind of create some space, like you said, right? So you have some time to defend it. So you're going to pour a lot of work into it up front, and then you want to be able to reap the rewards of that work over time. And it's supposed to be an incentive because it's a lot of work up front. So that it's an incentive that you get to reap those rewards for a limited period of time, right? And if it's much less work up front, it actually makes a lot more sense to not defend people's ability to defend that over time because it wasn't that much work in the first place. And then also like the variance, like you can take an idea, like, you know, I think famous something like a character like Mickey Mouse, like world renowned, everybody recognizes it. If you copy that, then like you're violating their IP. But you can get just far enough away that some people might consider it. There's some gray area where it's like it's a mouse. It's not exactly the same thing, but people kind of can see it. Some people will, some people won't. And it's like with AI tools, you could always just figure out how do you get into the gray area or how do you get just on the safe side of that boundary? And it takes you no time to do it. And so the whole idea of defending IP, like long term, it doesn't seem like it would make any sense. But if your job, if your livelihood is you create content and IP, and you're not really thinking about like where are LLMs and AI generative stuff going to take it, I can understand being like very cautious of that and wanting to make sure that you control and own it and defend it. But you're kind of like a little bit backward looking. You're thinking about the old system, the way it used to work, how hard it was to do, and you're not like plugging into the new system. So I would encourage if people do think that IP needs to kind of stay as it is, I would say apply it with the lens. You can say, oh, all these LLMs are stealing my IP. They are. That's kind of how these things are going, though. So is it stealing anymore? I think we have to redefine our understanding of what ownership is. I mean, writ large, probably across society, both IP and otherwise. I mean, like property rights should be reassessed now that we have Bitcoin. but I think IP is, you know, kind of, let's say, an early casualty of that reassessment.
Max chimes in and says, I agree that information by nature is abundant and wants to be free. IP ownership creates artificial scarcity and does not acknowledge reality as it is. He's going to speak to it next week. So we can continue this conversation next week.
And he's a creator. He's a rapper.
Well, that's so I think the response to this delete IP movement.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a movement yet, but I think a lot of technologists agree on the patent angle, but then creators, I think you have to debate patents separate from like copyright and trademark.
Yeah, they're different.
And I think I would find it harder to argue on the copyright trademark
about deleting IP for that
versus I don't have a strong position there. I'd have more to learn. Patents
seem
I'm not an expert on patents, but like I just have, I mean, I am, you know, I'm on the board of COPA, which is the Cryptocurrency Open Patent Alliance.
Right.
Where we've formed it as a defensive measure for the whole industry, you know, it involves Coinbase and Block and many, many companies in the cryptocurrency space,
right,
and even non-cryptocurrency companies as well. And really the purpose of that was kind of to delete IP within the capabilities that such an organization could do.
Meaning it's meant to be purely defensive and just like bring everybody under the tent of defense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Cool.
So if you join, you're a member, then you sign up to not sue other
and
members.
You have to contribute, or like, is it required that you contribute any existing IP to?
It's gone through iterations. Or? Originally, you had to hand over your entire patent portfolio that was related to cryptocurrency patents, and now that's optional.
Mm-hmm. When you hand it over, you still get full defense just through that umbrella.
Yeah, but others
also get it. Yeah,
it's pretty tricky because you can loan it. Like if I have a patent and then you get sued, I can like loan the patent to you that you can use during the trial or whatever. And it's very.
Is there usually commerce
unusual
around that? Like people, like if you were to loan me a patent,
that's a good question.
Pay you for that I don't privilege?
Huh. I don't know, but we should. I think this will be a recurring theme on the show, probably, because it relates to all technology, all software, Bitcoin, AI. So another thing that has always mildly worried me about open source software within Bitcoin, because that's what I currently care about, but this would apply to any open source software, is, you know, you can have your software licensed like MIT,
mm-hmm.
But if I introduce new code that has a patent behind it, other contributors who merge it might not know that, and then it gets adopted. Like imagine the worst case scenario, like Bitcoin Core, someone submits code that's patented. No one knows that. It gets merged. It gets deployed. Everyone deploys it. And now the whole Bitcoin network is dependent on this. And then all of a sudden, like the patent troll is like, gotcha.
Yeah.
And then, you know, well, it's decentralized. Who do you sue? Well, you go to Coinbase and you sue. You go to Block. You go to all mm-hmm. the big companies that run Bitcoin software and you sue them. So that's always felt like an attack vector to, mm-hmm. to me. And I'm not exactly sure how vigilant. What the processes look like for could this code be patented?
Are there a lot of changes in which third-party libraries Bitcoin depends on? Like, does that change somewhat frequently? I would assume it's fairly static.
Well, within Bitcoin Core specifically, there's a strong culture of minimizing dependencies to the point of like almost none. mainly for security reasons, but it would also be for that reason too.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But like, what are the ones that do like just simple, like some sort of computation accelerator or something? Or there is some dependencies that have not been able to get rid of.
I could not name one because they, you know, libsec P256K1 is the cryptography like library that implements the elliptical curve, but that's basically sort of in-house.
In-house meaning Bitcoin. Mm. Yeah. So it's like part of the immaculate conception of Bitcoin. Is it actually?
Like LDK is also extremely stringent on not taking on dependencies to the point of like, you know, if you want to do like logging or something, there's a zillion different logging libraries you can import. And it's like, well, most developers are like, of course, I don't want to like rewrite a logger myself. I'll just use this. But like LDK is like, nope, we're going to write our own logger. But most projects aren't super pedantic over dependencies because it's just not the culture of most software. I mean, typical optimized software development is you do want to reuse code.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? JavaScript and TypeScript applications do that in spades, but they're also like the least secure because of that.
Right. I know we got about 8 minutes before we run over. I don't know how your day looks. We started a little late, but
what time is it?
It's 1:22.
Okay. We started 10 minutes late, so
yeah,
we can go like 15-20 minutes.
Okay.
Should we talk about Q Day?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. What is Q Day? Yeah. It's not Quadrillion Day.
All right, yeah. I confused you earlier. And quantum day. So we've talked about quantum computing and the risks it poses to Bitcoin on previous episodes. I think that was precipitated like in November, December when Google announced Willow is like a big advancement in quantum computing. This has been like, I mean, this has always been known within Bitcoin and all of cryptography at large. A lot of cryptography, the foundation of it working is that really large numbers, we have algorithms to multiply them, but we don't know how, we don't have algorithms to efficiently divide. Without a quantum computer, like, we have proofs that show like no future computer will be able to divide these large numbers. With that property, you can have asymmetrical cryptography where you have a private key. From that, you can generate a public key, but you can't take a public key and reverse it back to the private key, which would require division of large numbers. So that's the basis of all this stuff, and not just Bitcoin, but all security. So with a quantum computer, though, there have been people who have devised algorithms with a theoretical computer that would be able to solve that problem. So it's just simply waiting on, you know, the development of a quantum computer. Historically, most people in Bitcoin are like, that's either will never happen, or it's like 50 years away. There's very long ways in the future. So not an urgent problem. You know, with the Willow announcement, I think Microsoft had an announcement. There's also lots of startups in the space. You know, there's one that just raised like $750 million in a Series A that are, you know, touting fast progress on quantum computers. There's a contingent of people now that are saying it's not never or 50 years away. It's imminent. It's 3 to 4 years away. So there's several questions here. One is like, what do you believe, or how much does the world collectively actually know, or versus like we actually don't know? And then like, what does Bitcoin do? What are our options? As far as like assessing like what the risk really is, I'm not sure, because most of the people who say it's imminent have a vested interest in saying that. Yeah. So it's really. And you know, I'm certainly not an expert on quantum computer technology and its trend, and I don't think you are either. So, and most people aren't, right? So when they're like, if you're in Bitcoin, you're trying to assess this, you're not an expert. Who do you believe? The people who are like researchers at universities, researchers at companies, a startup raising $750 million, all of those people are naturally inclined to be like, we're making fast progress. Yeah, yeah. It's going to be real. It's really going to work. We're going to be able to manufacture it. It's going to be able to operate. So I really don't know. But I do know that people I trust deeply and respect a lot are taking this more seriously. Like there's some investors I know that are very long Bitcoin, and also investors in some of these quantum computer startups. Mm-hmm. So they are getting information. They know Bitcoin really well, but they're also getting information flows from the quantum companies. And they think the Bitcoin dev community is under investing in figuring solutions out. I will say though that the Bitcoin development community is waking up a little bit more of taking it more seriously. There's active discussion on the Bitcoin dev mailing list and delving. So some community forums, that's good. And there's one of the really great applied cryptographers who has like a 10-year track record in Bitcoin. I've heard that person is probably going to make this his primary project soon to look into this. Hmm. I think that's exciting. But like, what does it mean to look into it? So one track is what are all the different cryptography quantum resistant cryptography options that are available. What are the trade-offs? Because the big trade-off is all of them are enormous signatures. Like, so it's more data and they're typically way slower to compute. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's not as simple as like, yeah, let's just upgrade Bitcoin with the most quantum resistant solution, right? So looking at all those technologies, improving them, but the improving them really comes from outside the Bitcoin community. It comes from the cryptography experts, right? Mm-hmm. So there's that track. Then within Bitcoin is like, well, here's what we have that can be applied. What's our best solution? Then there's how do you deploy it? So like we could change Bitcoin today to add an option to do quantum resistant signatures. So we could do that today. And then every wallet could adopt that. And every wallet could, when you receive Bitcoin into your wallet, it could create an additional spending path that spends it with this quantum resistant signature, as well as all the existing tech, so that in the future, if there's an emergency situation where there's a quantum computer that's going to steal everyone's Bitcoin, there could be an instant or, you know, like a rapid response fork that makes all the legacy spending paths invalid.
Mm-hmm.
But for everyone who had upgraded wallets and their coins so that they have this escape valve spending path that's quantum resistant, they can still spend their coins, even if it's using technology that is, it's going to be more costly to spend.
So stuff that we have today that is relatively easy to know how to do. It's just expensive from a computation perspective.
So that's like one option. Like, we could do that today. Just take the best tech we have today, add that as an option for spending. All wallets could do it. And it's pretty, there's with Taproot, there's no cost in adding those extra spending scripts, or that's a little bit of a misnomer, but
you can have it recorded in a way that requires the extra that makes the extra spending thing optional until you flip a flag or something. You have like some new consensus flag that you flip.
Yep. So that's possible. So I think that's one like valid option that should be considered. It is being considered. If it is like 20, 30, 40, 50 years away, then like every 5 or 10 years, we could also just upgrade. Like when there's major leaps in quantum resistant cryptography, that's much more efficient than like upgrade Bitcoin again and then get wallets to transition to that. That could be done. But another question around this is just philosophically, what should be done with coins that don't upgrade?
Right.
So even if we assume, yes, we change Bitcoin, yes, we add quantum resistant cryptography, that doesn't mean everyone upgrades their wallet. And especially for wallets that have lost keys or people are dead or, you know, it's literally impossible to upgrade.
Which could be 10, 20% of the network.
Of the coins?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was an estimate by Peter Wolle maybe 6 years ago of around, I think it was 6 million coins exposed. And they're
exposed meaning?
There's a little different metric than what we were just talking about. But exposed meaning the public key is known.
Okay.
So there's certain ways, there's certain Bitcoin scripts which the public key is just always already exposed. And then if you reuse addresses, then it gets exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So if you total all that up, it's like 6 million. So if no one upgraded, there'd be like 6 million coins that could be stolen immediately. But in terms of like coins that have forever been lost, estimates are usually around like 4 million or so.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, a substantial amount. So
and the exposed thing, meaning you would look, the public key has been exposed. So you can start from the public key, use quantum algorithms to derive the private key, and then you'd be able to spend those. So the 6 million being exposed means there's a path with quantum to get from public key to private key.
Yep.
Okay.
With a sufficiently powerful quantum computer, all coins could be stolen though, because even if you have coins that are at an address that has been hashed and is not sort of at rest, is not exposed. When you go to spend them, you reveal the pub key.
Mm.
So like if I assign a transaction, broadcast it on the network, it's sitting in the mempool waiting for 10 minutes or whatever to get mined, the pub key is exposed. So if the quantum computer is fast enough to like, it would just monitor the mempool. And if it can like reverse that pub key into a private key within 10 minutes, it's going to steal that as well.
And so basically it's, the issue is with quantum, if you can go from that public key sitting in the mempool to derive the private key and then issue a new transaction and presumably bid more, is that the mechanics of what you're trying to do as an attacker there?
So then you'd be at a scorched earth policy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so then as the attacker, you'd also want to be the miner too.
Right.
Then you get the money either way.
Right.
So if you have a quantum computer and you steal 6 million coins, you're going to have plenty of money to buy hash rate
right. Yeah.
to steal the other coins. So that's in a scenario where no one's upgraded. But if in a scenario where, okay, great, we have introduced quantum resistant cryptography to Bitcoin, there's mass adoption of upgrading, great, we're in a better situation, but there's still probably 4 million coins that will never be upgraded. And that would be, so then the question is what to do with those coins, right?
Because mm-hmm.
if we don't do anything and let one entity steal all 4 million, that is a very significant event and could be very disruptive to the network. What if they dump all those coins, or they just play,
right.
they could play economic games by dumping and buying and dumping and buying. And if if this is in 20 or 30 years and the whole world's dependent on Bitcoin, that could be very, very catastrophic. So one option is it is what it is. Just let it steal the coins. We don't want humans to interfere with the rules. Mm-hmm. And those are the rules. Whoever has a private key to spend and can produce a valid signature is the owner of the coins. You can just take that very strict philosophy. I think there are a lot of people actually that believe that. At our recent SF Bit Devs here at Presidio Bitcoin, we did a show of hands, and I think a third or half the people voted for like that option. So that's one option.
It seems reasonable, but like, what are you trading it off against?
Well, certainly. I mean,
are you trying to burn it all or what?
Well, yeah. So what's another option? You burn them. So you don't let the quantum computer steal. You burn the coins.
So hopefully you're not like off on like Safari while this happens.
Well, no. I mean, if we in a world where we provide upgradability to quantum resistant technology today, and if there's not queue day is not for 20 years, you have 20 years to upgrade. So you can do all the Safari as you want, and you have plenty of time to upgrade, right?
Yeah, just don't spend 21
because
years.
Because you upgrade today, you go on as many safaris as you want, and queue day occurs, and then you're safe.
Yeah.
Your coins wouldn't be burnt. The legacy spending paths would be burnt, but you still have a spending path to spend your coins, right?
Yeah.
So it's for people who didn't upgrade, and that's either like the coins that literally cannot be upgraded because the private key is lost, or just people who are laggards, didn't get the word. I don't know. This feels like the kind of event that...
It'd be big enough.
The word would get around.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, what to do with the coins that cannot be upgraded because there's no private key available. And so the other option is, so one option is let the quantum computer steal or access, spend. The other is burning. And, the argument for burning is that, well, that's it. It avoids this catastrophic event of one entity gaining, access to a fifth or more of the total supply,
right?
Which would be very disruptive. But, but it's a major violation of property rights as well. I mean, either option is a violation of property rights. Like no one, if you are the legitimate owner of these coins, you're the one that has the private key, then it's hard to argue either of those is not a violation of that property right.
Yep. I feel like part of the beauty of the sovereignty of Bitcoin is kind of like, you can just set it and forget it. Like if you have the private key controlled somewhere, you don't have to be online and available and paying attention, you can just like literally be on safari or on the beach, or you can just like, part of the beauty is that you don't need to keep checking in. And I feel like anything that requires you to sort of watchtower or monitor or sort of be online is kind of already a bit of a violation of sovereignty.
Agreed. But again, this is an existential event, right?
And either of these options
violate that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not like, oh, burning violates it, so we don't want to do it. It's like, oh, both. You lose out with both those. Now,
it's such a big advance in the world.
A twist on the burning, though, a variation of burning is that it's like a temporary burn, meaning like, is there a way post Q day for the legitimate owner of coins to prove that they're the owner of the coins and reclaim those coins in a quantum resistant way so that the quantum computers can't steal that transfer? Right. And there's discussion on the dev mailing list now about how zero knowledge proofs could be used for that. I still need to study it a bit more to be able to explain it, but I know that discussion is happening. Someone shared with me the philosophy too, that I mean, this seems strictly better to me than burning, like true burning that you can never because it opens up it opens up a can of worms of how to prove that they're mine. Like, there's some coins that were burned and maybe I'm like, they're mine. And then you're like, no, they're mine. And obviously there's a technological solution where my original private key that you don't have, I can use in a quantum resistant safe way, then great.
I mean, that's not the mempool.
Then it's really not disputable anymore. Versus like if I like show my ID or something. but I guess the point is you can have as much time after Q day as you need to form social consensus on like, yes, this is what the rule should be for those that didn't make the leap in Q day and had their coins burned, but they still had the private key.
Is Q day, by the way, that's the name of the day when we think, if we were to come to consensus on a new way, Q day is the day when everybody flips to that? Is that what you mean by Q day? Or that Q day is the day quantum is invented or deployed?
No, it's the day that a quantum computer is powerful enough to steal Bitcoin.
Okay.
And as we already talked about, there's even degrees of that too, right?
Right.
Meaning you reach a point where it might, in 10 years, it could crack one key. So it could try to target the one with the most funds
right
at that point in time. But if 10 years later, it might not have any funds. So
yeah,
that's not very practical. Q day means like Bitcoin's being stolen by a quantum computer. So there's all kinds of like challenges and flaws with like, oh, what are the rules to claim coins? But it's nice to have the optionality of like, okay, this might take 10, 20 years to like actually come to consensus on and make a change to Bitcoin for those people to reclaim coins. But it's better to have that option and take as much time as needed than just not have any option at all.
Mm-hmm. So anybody kind of team slow and steady would hope for Q day to be pretty far out, so we have plenty of time to do it, but it sounds like there are reasonable upgrade paths or, you know, debates to have, and sort of we have to see how technology progresses to figure out what we will do. How do you think consensus would happen there? Like, would it be the mailing lists and a bunch of people gathering trying to...
Consensus for which decision?
Yeah.
That's a question for you. Which decision?
Oh, well, for... Do you want to have the upgrade path or...
Yeah.
Burn it. Sorry, maybe I'm not.
Those are orthogonal. One decision is: do we upgrade Bitcoin relatively soon and introduce quantum resistant tech? That's one decision.
Okay,
and that gives a safety valve for anyone who wants to upgrade. An inefficient safety valve, but
inefficient. But we're pretty sure that it would work regardless of what happens.
The quantum computer would not be able to. I mean. Yeah. So if we upgraded Bitcoin to have that, and then I upgraded my wallet to add this quantum resistant spending path, and then in the future, there is another change to consensus rules that disallowed the legacy spending paths, then my coins are safe from a quantum computer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're talking about. So one decision is, do we change the consensus rule soon mm-hmm. to allow for that type of upgradability, a safety valve, right?
Yeah.
Second sub-decision to that is like which technology to use for the mm-hmm. quantum-resistant cryptography. That would be a sub-decision. Separately, in the future, nearing Q-Day, do we burn unupgraded coins or not?
Right.
Where burn is a looser term, a version of burn, like holding,
mm-hmm.
holding pattern.
Back, yeah.
Do we do that? And I think that'll be like insanely hard to get consensus, because how do we know we're gonna argue and disagree on like how imminent it is.
Yeah.
Even right now, it's like some people are saying 3 to 4 years away, and others are like 50 years, and others are like never.
Yep.
It's impossible. It's not even possible to build this type of computer, right? So if we do assume the technology progresses and it becomes, there's less people saying never, and people are shrinking their time frames, there's still going to be like, some people are like, it's tomorrow.
Yeah.
And others will be like, it's 3 months from now. And others are like, it's 2 years from now. And then until everyone really converges on like it's tomorrow, where it's like very imminent, you're not going to have consensus on like, let's burn all these people's coins.
Right.
That's like violating. Like if someone proposed to do that today, it would be outrageous.
Yeah.
Right. So that's another question. But I think it's important to be thinking about this and keep discussing it, not only the technological development, the deployment mechanisms, but also the philosophy around this.
And you said this person is taking on their own kind of independent research to try to get an analysis or understanding of this?
Well, there's different like software development here. Again, there's like stuff that has nothing to do with Bitcoin, like cryptography experts in the world.
Yeah.
I spent no time studying that. I just assume there's a bunch of smart people who nerd out on cryptography.
Yeah.
And obviously, they've already done a lot of quantum resistant stuff. I mean, they come up with algorithms that break, that allow a quantum computer to break cryptography. And other people have come up with quantum resistant technology. So that's still that is a whole track by itself,
right?
And maybe Bitcoiners should start studying that more to understand state of the art. The speed doesn't need more investment. I mean, as Bitcoiners get richer and richer, like maybe Bitcoiners should be funding that technology, even though it applies to the whole world, not just.
And somebody they're going to say, "Oh, he was early to Bitcoin. He was there before it was even."
But even having said that, like this is if Q Day is literally 3 or 4 years away, I'm actually far more worried about the world than I am Bitcoin, because this will wreak havoc everywhere, like nuclear facilities, airlines, the banks, like energy grid, everything will just fail.
Yeah,
we'll be weakened. It'll be absolute chaos in the world. It'll be like,
good thing you got a bunker.
We need to go to like our Iowa bunker or something.
Reveal it on the air. Don't reveal the location. Yeah.
So getting back to like funding cryptography development, like the world should be doing that, not just Bitcoiners. but then the developer I was mentioning, that's not a cryptography researcher. It's an applied cryptography person. So he knows cryptography super well, but he's a Bitcoiner who takes cryptography and applies it to Bitcoin.
Yep.
And that usually does involve like writing proofs and coming. Mm-hmm. So there are those types of people needed as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the kind of Bitcoin software engineers who figure out like, okay, how are we actually going to upgrade Bitcoin to do this safety valve? And then how are we going to upgrade Bitcoin to handle burning, this like looser version of burning? There needs to be technical people figuring out all the details there.
Right.
And then the broader Bitcoin community needs to figure out like, what are our answers to these questions?
Right.
When and how?
And I'm not trying to figure out the exact path or whatever right now. Yeah, we can wrap. But I was kind of getting at, I wanted to bring up a question that I think we'd addressed a couple weeks ago, which is the Bitcoin mailing list, the dev mailing list, kind of got the boot from Google that was previously the host, right? And I was wondering, has anything happened? Has anybody figured out how the new one should be run?
Don't know.
Okay, because I feel like
the new one.
Like, there has to be some new way that people can gather and discuss?
No, they're using the Google mailing list.
Oh, sorry. I thought the Google mailing list got shut down. I thought Google gave them the boot.
No, it was already operational 2 weeks ago when we talked about it.
Oh, okay. It was just a minor outage and then they got it recovered. But we'd hope there's some resilience, but it's not an urgent need right now because yeah. Back on. Okay.
And we don't really know why it was taken down.
Right. I'm guessing it just got caught in some dragnet of like random crypto stuff that they're trying to crack down.
Yep.
Cool. Any last minute comments? I know we're sort of well over because we started late and ending a little late. Any last minute comments, ideas, thoughts you want to?
I'll do a quick, rapid soundbite on another topic that is not Bitcoin consensus rules, but it is Bitcoin policy rules. OP return is a way to stuff data into the Bitcoin blockchain instead of like money transactions. And it's been used, I mean, I think it's existed since the days of Satoshi. It's been used slash abused by different systems that want to put data in the blockchain. All the colored coin mechanisms from like 2013, 2014 era were using it for that. At that time, Bitcoin Core developers came up with standardness rules around the amount of data that could be stored in OP return, limiting it, I think, to 80 bytes, so that it couldn't be, quote, abused beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
That's an opinion, right? I mean, if you believe Bitcoin is intended for peer-to-peer cash and money transactions, then like, and it's not for storing just random data,
right?
If you hold that view, then it's like, okay, well, you create this policy and don't allow the transactions, then it's consistent with that view. Another view, of course, just like if you're willing to pay for the block space, you can put whatever you want in it, right?
Yep.
There's two different philosophies, but the point is that standardness rule existed. It's not consensus, but it did prevent transactions from being relayed around the network and restricting them, limiting them for how they can reach miners to get mined. But because it's not in the consensus rules, miners themselves can insert transactions with OP return as large of values as they want. And what we discovered the last 2 years with inscriptions and ordinals and people putting, like, literally taking up an entire block to put like videos and images
right,
in,
right.
They just went straight to the miners mining pools developed services that said, just send us the data you want to put
the
in there.
Slipstream
from Marathon is an example of that. And so they just got around those rules. So they're even if you hold the view that we should have those policies and we shouldn't have that data, it's an ineffective tool. So I think Bitcoin Core developer. So I came to the realization a year ago that like we should just eliminate that particular rule because it's ineffective.
Yeah.
even though I personally. I mean, I see both camps. I mean, I personally think Bitcoin should be used for money and not the other stuff. I don't think we need to like go out of our way to like block it. I don't even think we really can. I also think long term it will be used for money stuff. That's where the high value is, and it just crowds everything else out. That's my own view. But regardless of my view, it doesn't matter. It's an ineffective tool. Let's remove it, because by having it, that means all these other services pop up, and those are unhealthy for Bitcoin. We don't want there to be proprietary company services where everyone gives them their transactions.
Right.
That's not decentralized. That's centralized.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I think core devs are waking up to that, and they're now proposing removing or relaxing that OP return policy rule.
And the policy rule says that it can exist, the 80 bytes or whatever?
It limits it to 80 bytes.
It limits it to 80, and they're saying what? They're saying limit it to zero or don't limit it? Or
well, zero would mean that doesn't solve the problem. It has to increase.
Okay.
The users of this want more bytes, not less bytes. They want to put more data on the blockchain, not less. So if they limit it to zero, then they'd still use Slipstream.
Okay.
We don't want them to use Slipstream.
More generous than 80 so that people don't go out of band to get this in.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, the debate is like, do you just pick a bigger number or do you have it unlimited?
Right.
And I don't know. I mean, it'll be interesting to see everyone's ideas and views there. It seems to me like you just have to like get rid of the rule.
Hmm. So it just could be as big as somebody wants to try to fit.
Yeah. That's what's already happening in the blockchain using these other tools. So.
Yeah. All right. Cool.
I really don't even see any argument because it's been proven that it can be done, is being done. I see no argument to the contrary.
All right. Let it rip. Okay. So
that's it.
Last little bit.
Yep.
Okay. Good.
Good show.
Good show. Yeah.
All right.
Thanks for being patient with all of our technical difficulties and getting Max here and Max back out. But we will see you next week.
Okay. Bye-bye.